Okay, as this chapter opens and he's ready to kind of go into battle, we see. Right.
And now he has thousands
and thousands of people. So many that he has to split them up, doesn't he? In other words, he has so many people who are loyal to him, who are willing to fight, that he has to divide them into thirds, and then to each of those there were into thousands and hundreds. So he had to have a lot of captains and whatever you want to call them over each of the groups. So during that time, there had been a great increase in the number of people who were following him. But the Bible doesn't really tell us about a lot of those reasons. You know, it doesn't give us much indication about where they came from. One thing we can see from this, though, is when he divided them into thirds, two of the groups were people from Israel, but the third one, the Gittite, was a non-Israelite. And he had a lot of followers that weren't from Israel. We've seen that in the past. So they may have been divided up for that reason in that way, so that this group over here, Ittai's group, would be the non-Israelites. Again, it doesn't say, but that would seem to make sense from the way he's kind of dividing them up. But it has been a tremendous growth. Whatever the time period is, it has seen a tremendous growth in his manpower. Those people who are willing to fight for him. And of course, with that many people, he had to learn to delegate. He couldn't possibly try and train all of them or be over thousands and thousands of people all by himself. Remember, Moses had that problem many, many years ago about doing the same thing. Moses was trying to do everything for himself, and his father-in-law came by and said, "You know, you got to stop that, Moses. You're wearing yourself out. You've got to start delegating and having people be over groups." So this is what David's having to do as well. And also from that, we get that there is, he wants to know. He says, first of all, "I'm going to go out with you myself." And then the people say, "That's a bad strategic idea, because Absalom's group are going to zero in on you. And if they get you killed, then they assume that the battle's done." So they say, "David, you stay home." They said, how did they put it? "Not even if half of us die will they care about that. But you're worth 10,000 of us." It's kind of like going after someone like bin Laden or somebody like that, who's a big, big leader of a group. So that's what they do, and they say, "Don't do it. You're more help to us if you stay put."
How about the theory that Joab already has in his mind he wants to kill Absalom? He doesn't want him around.
Yep.
I mean, that's just a theory.
Yep. And we'll see, how much of that we might be able to get from our study. That's a good point, too. But he does say something in verse 5, which is really one of the main things in the chapter, of course. "Now the king commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai," those were the three leaders of the three groups, "deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. And of course, that's the whole chapter kind of revolves around that one statement. Was that, obviously from a father's standpoint, that was what he wanted. Was it a good idea from a king's standpoint or a military standpoint? Definitely not. He has charge of the whole nation, not just his son. And so he's got to be thinking, he's thinking that Absalom's his son, sure, but he also has to be thinking, what would happen if I was killed and Absalom took over as king? How would that affect the nation of Israel? And so right now, the only thing he's thinking about is his son. just don't harm my son. Which again, Absalom's the leader of the opposing group. And he would be the one that you would want to get rid of. And so, you know, David's probably in a quandary as to what to do, but obviously the father side of him wins over the king side of him. And he was putting that obligation before really God's obligation. I think God's obligation for him was to destroy Absalom. But he was not doing that. He was putting Absalom above that. All right, now would someone read the next three verses, 6 through 8? We'll start talking about the battle itself. Okay? Yes, 6 through 8.
So the people went out into the field against Israel and the battle in the wood of Ephraim, where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there was there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. For the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, and the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured.
All right. Very interesting battle, isn't it? I mean, it really is. When you look at it from a military standpoint, it's a very interesting battle. So they, you know, they're engaged. It says it's in the woods of Ephraim. Now, years and years ago, what people call Palestine today was a very heavily wooded, it was a very agricultural, fertile area compared to what it is now. Now it's not much of anything. But years ago, it was a very beautiful place. You know how they describe Canaan, right? Land that flowed with milk and honey. Well, it's definitely not a land that flows with milk and honey today. So over those centuries, it's changed a lot. So we have to go back and think about what it would have been like in David's time, not what it looks like today. So then there was what we would call a forest, basically, in Ephraim. And that's where the battle took place, which is an unusual place to have a battle. You usually think about battles being out in the open on a plain or whatever, or on top of a mountain. But here, they're having it in the woods. And I think we see God's providence, because God is obviously on David's side, isn't he? And the Israelites, in other words, Absalom's group, were overthrown by David's group, and there were 22,000 that were killed there of the Israelites. And it said, the woods devoured more people than the sword devoured. You've got to watch those trees, they're tricky. But it says that whatever happened in the woods, I mean, there could have been, you know, sinkholes, there could have been, you know, whatever. But whatever, you know, over half of that 22,000 was killed because of the geography, the terrain. There might have been steep ravines, and, you know, I don't know what all was in the woods, but it was not a good place for Absalom's group to be that day. And again, I think we almost have to say that God's providence was behind the whole thing. So, most of them were killed then by the forest. So, then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, and the mule which was under him went on. And it doesn't say much about exactly where Absalom was. Was Absalom, you know, way away from the rest of the group? He seems to be alone. I mean, from reading that one verse, he seems to be alone. Whether he was trying to escape the slaughter, doesn't say. But whatever it is, he is alone. And he gets caught in the branches. It doesn't say his hair got caught in the branches. It just says he got caught in the branches. I guess his head could have got stuck between some thick branches. It didn't say. But however it happened, he got stuck. I guess it was apparently a large, you know, had big limbs, it was a large tree, and somehow he got stuck hanging there, and he couldn't get himself out. And the mule, as most mules are, were not very helpful. That mule was not helpful at all. Just went on its merry way and not concerned about much of anything. So a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. So Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him? And why'd you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. That's an interesting response. Why didn't you kill him? You had the enemy at your mercy, I guess we would call it. Absalom couldn't do anything to retaliate. Why didn't you just kill him with your sword? Easy. You go up, stab him, it's done. You can tell Joab is angry. You can just tell it from the words. He is angry. Why in the world didn't you kill him? You had the opportunity. But I think the response is another lesson from the chapter that's great. Because the response is, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels. Now, remember Joab said 10 shekels. Though if I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. He was doing exactly what he was told. He was being submissive to the king's desires. And remember going back to the beginning of the chapter, everybody heard that. Remember, that's what the verse said. Everybody heard it. So it wasn't just the leaders or a few. Everybody heard, don't touch Absalom. Well, of course, Joab could care less about what the command was. He was going to do what he wanted. But just like anything else in the Bible, a command is a command. You know, we've seen throughout the history, even of the Lord's church, how some treat commands as a command and some treat commands as something they may do or something they may not do. Well, this guy, he saw the command as just exactly what it was, a command. And he didn't question the command. That was the king's command, and I'm going to follow it, and that's the end of the story. Not going to try and make up a circumstance where it's okay to disregard the king's command, something else that's popular today. You know, God gives us a command and we try and come up with a scenario where it's all right to disobey the command. Well, this guy says, no, there's no circumstance. Command is a command. We're supposed to follow exactly what God says. So, he said, it wouldn't make any difference if you gave me instead of 10, if you gave me 1,000. I'm not going to do it. He says, otherwise I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. What a response. I love that response. Boy, that's a lesson in itself too. How he responds.
Pretty bold.
Yes, absolutely.
Pretty much told him no.
Yeah, he did. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's true. So, you know, there's a lot involved in these. You know, of course, you can read the Old Testament, just read it through and not get a lot of the little nuances. But there's a lot of those in the Bible. There's a lot. And I think there are things we can learn from. Just like this guy, it's just a little section in one little chapter, but it still teaches us a lesson. Things that, you know, you and I need to hear. So he says, I'm not going to deal falsely against my own life. I'm not going to do that. I mean, that's something that would be crazy. Why in the world would I do that? Again, going back to the king's commands. So Joab responds, I cannot linger with you. I'm not going to put up with you. I've wasted my time with you already. And he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart, while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree, and 10 young men who bore Joab's armor, surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him. I mean, they were going to make sure he was dead. There, you know, with 3 spears through your heart, there wasn't much doubt anyway. But still, with the armor bearers, 2, you know, it was something that was definitely going to be done. You know, Joab. When you look at his history, he was supposed to be under David's authority the whole time. But a lot of times he just kind of did what he wanted. Yeah, he was He was kind of a second in command, but sometimes he put himself as first in command. And this is another, I mean, this was just blatant. I mean, there wasn't any way to say that, well, Absalom was trying to kill me, or Absalom was this or that or whatever. I mean, it was just blatant. He just blatantly disregarded the king's command. No other way to look at it. So,
do you think maybe the 10 young men that also put their spears in him were enticed by Joab to do such a thing?
Oh, well, so, very possible.
The whole blame wouldn't fall on him. He could say, hey, look,
we all had a hand in it. Yeah. It's like, you know, 10 people shot him. We don't know which bullet actually killed him. And that's possible, right? Well, anyway, Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name. To this day it is called Absalom's Monument. So it was a good thing he had built one for himself during his lifetime, because he wasn't going to get one after. Because he died a very, a dishonorable death, I guess you would call it. Well, then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said to him, you shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead. Then Joab said to the Cushite, see, this guy is not an Israelite. The first one was an Israelite. This guy's not an Israelite. Go, tell the king what you've seen. So the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran, and Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. So Joab said, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? But whatever happens, he said, let me run. So he said to him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate, to the wall, lifted his eyes, and looked, there was a man running alone. Then the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, if he's alone, there's news in his mouth. And he came rapidly and drew near. Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, there's another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. So the watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he's a good man and comes with good news. Now that's quite an assumption. Just because he's a good man, he's going to have good news? That's stretching it a bit. So Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, all is well. Well, that can be interpreted in a number of different ways. But that's all he said. Then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. The king said, is the young man Absalom safe? Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. Wow. Now that's quite a reply. Now that's going around the answer several times, skirting the issue. He'd be another good politician that we've talked about before. Skirts the issue. Doesn't come out and try to answer it. Well, the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. Just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, there's good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? So Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. And of course that was the, I don't know if you want to call it the final straw, I guess. And David understands that Absalom is indeed dead, like all the enemies, just like the Cushite said. And so we end up with his mourning, his lamenting, and the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, O Absalom, my son, my son. Maybe he kept hoping that his son would change. You know, maybe he had kept hoping during all this time. And maybe that's why he didn't want Absalom to be harmed. Maybe in the back of his mind he kept hoping that Absalom would change and come back and repent and stop rebelling. He didn't, but death destroyed all hope, just like it does nowadays.
Why do you think in verse 29 did the young man just chicken out?
I don't think he wanted to. When he got there, I don't think he actually wanted to be the one that said Absalom is dead. Valued his life. Probably so. How exactly am I going to say this? But it's a very sad ending. I mean, Absalom was a rebel from the get-go almost, and had plots against David to be king, and used deception and treachery and just everything to try and take the crown, the throne from David. And surely he knew that David was God's appointed king. He was the anointed one of God. But Absalom was very proud and very arrogant, and he thought he was the one that should lead Israel. But during his life, he kept leaving God out of the picture, and that was the big problem. Kept leaving God out of the picture.
One of the very, very few people in the Bible that didn't have any offspring.
There's not, yeah, we don't have anything there about offspring there at all. He says something about, I don't have a son to keep my name in remembrance. So that's why he had built his own pillar, whatever he called it. Yeah, he called the pillar after his own name. And I don't know if we'll see anything in the future about that or not, but it was a sad ending to someone. It was just like he was on a course to be killed. He just kept going against God and going against God and going against God. And ultimately, you go against God that long, you're going to lose. And that's exactly what happened. And even though David is mourning and he's lamenting, all the hope was gone. There wasn't any more hope. And I think that was the saddest part of it all, was once Absalom died, there wasn't any more chances for him. There's no second chance. There was nothing left for him. And I think that's the saddest part of Absalom's story, is the fact that there was no second chance, no more hope for him at all. Well, thank you very much for your comments. And Lord willing, we'll look at chapter 19 next week. And still talks a little bit about David's lamenting and mourning over Absalom. And he comes back to Jerusalem. Some interesting things happen in the next chapter as well.